Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskans.
Welcome to Chinook. I'm Karen Michelle McPherson. Occasionally, we meet people who, through wit or charm or intelligence or just circumstances, have the power to change, to influence our lives. For Michael Krauss, professor of linguistics at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks, a woman of wit, charm, and intelligence changed his life, his professional life. The woman, an Eyak Indian, was named Anna Nelson Harry. She was born in Cordova in 1906, and she died at the age of 75 in February 1982. Professor Krauss.
This is a book in memory of Annie Nelson Harry, one of the very last of the of a whole Alaskan nation, the Eyak people. She was the last person whose dominant language was Eyak. There are now two other people still alive who can speak Eyak, but Annie was the last who spoke Eyak more easily than any other language. And she was that way, I think, to the end of her life. I met her in 1961 when I first began doing research in Alaska Native languages, and worked with her in 1963 and 64, 65, again in the late 60s and in the early 70s at Yakutat and wherever else I could meet her. Every chance that I had, because during those times I was concentrating all my research effort on documenting what was left of the Eyak language. The Eyak people were an independent nation of people who had their own language, living in the area between Yakutat and Cordova, and who were more or less caught in between Chugach and Tlingit. And were always a small nation, but by the time they were rediscovered by American anthropologists and ethnologists, there were only about 30 of these people left. They had suffered very greatly from the times of the canneries especially, and the early railroad days and developments in the Cordova-Catala area. And Annie was born into that frontier world of Cordova, raw and rough. Her life was certainly no picnic, but she's a very remarkable lady of great personal talent, abilities, and resilience. Suffered through all kinds of difficulties. She married in 1918, for the first time, to Galusha Nelson of Cordova, and had three sons with him. And then, after Galusha died in 1938, Annie moved in 1939, I believe, to Yakutat, and married there Samson Harry, and began her second family. She had two sons there, too. And lived the rest of her life in Yakutat. So she lived a life really in two parts. First the Cordova, Eyak, and then from 1906 to 1938, and then Yakutat Tlingit from 1938 to 1982. She, beside being one of the very last Eyak speakers, had the artistic gift of storytelling in her own language. She was not only the last who had that gift, but also by any standards, and I mean by literally any standards, was a artist of great accomplishment. So that it is the privilege of all of us, and an honor to the Yak people, that at the very end of their history, they produced what I would call a great artist. I spent a good deal of time with her in person, but even more time I spent with listening to every syllable, every letter, every word that she spoke on those tapes that I recorded from her, and spent many hours, many weeks, many months, and years, really, of listening to Annie on those tapes and editing and transcribing all of those EAC texts. So it's thanks to her that we not only have great EAC art, EAC narrative art recorded, and a goodly sample of EAC language spoken in connected narrative. She is responsible also for really salvaging the best parts and practically all we have left of EAC folklore. I've put together a selection of 10 of the 50 or so stories that she told on tape. In the original EAC, transcribed that way, and with an English close translation corresponding to it in a column along the same page, and then a free translation in English. And the most important part, of course, is the original EAC. And if you can't read the original EAC, then there's at least the close translation. I'm including along in the publication of this book a copy of the original tapes so that you can listen to what it sounds like and read it at the same time. EAC has two main types of stories, one called tsakl, which are traditional legends and myths, and then wacha, which means just stories, which can be more historical or more personal. But the oral style of the same is not that different, and Anna sometimes weaves these two things together. The interesting part about this book is not the standard folk tales, even though they're well done in EAC, but then what Annie herself personally adds to these stories by manipulating them in various ways. And let me give you an example as in a pair of stories, which two traditional stories, which she told on two separate occasions in 1963. One is the story of the lake dwarves, and the other is a story of the giant rat. The lake dwarves were little fellows who lived around puddles in the grass and were maybe the size of your thumb. And this great hunter, who was busy one day hunting bears, heard some funny little voices down in the grass and looked around and didn't see anybody, and finally spied these little creatures who were very busy scurrying around catching a couple of mice. One slightly larger mouse was a brown bear for them, and the other was a black bear. And they had killed one of the mice, and it took four men to carry a mouse hindquarter into the canoe, and they were all in a big hubbub over this when the hunter bent down and picked up one of these fellows and for a closer look, and the little fellow wailed piteously to be released, and gave him his magical hunting leaf to be released. Ran back to his people and said, "The man mountain monster will be after us. Let's get out of here." And they scurried back to their home across the way, and in fear that the man would be after them. But the man was too busy to run after creatures like that, because he was had more important things to do, namely hunting bears. That's one story, rather wittily told. In fact, stopped right more or less in the middle, because traditionally that story goes on to tell about actually what happened to those little people who were very, very important in both Eyak and Eskimo folklore as important spirits of the land. But she more or less stopped the story there because, with a little chuckle, at pointing out the irony of how important those little folks figured they were, and how much too busy the man was hunting bears to follow after insignificant little creatures like that. The next story that she told on a separate occasion, but it's hard to believe that she didn't have one in the back of her mind as she told the other, was the story of the giant rat. There was reputed somewhere between Yakutat and Cordova to live a giant monster rat in a cliff someplace, which had two holes, one coming out at the bottom along the tide line and the other coming out along the top. This man and his wife and child were going along in a canoe near the hole, where the place where this monster was reputed to have its hole. By the way, this monster's hair was as long as a black bear's fur, Anna notes at one point. They were paddling along, and the wife said, gee, it would be interesting, or started to say, gee, it would be interesting to see that giant rat. And the man said, shut up, it'll cause us all kinds of trouble. And sure enough, just as they finished saying that, this monster rat came up out of the water and overturned the canoe, and the wife perished, and the man grabbed his child and the rat, its hair was as long as a black bear's fur, and rode it into its cave. And the rat kept the man and his wife and his child prisoner in this cave and fed it by sitting on the food to cook it and so on. And the man tried various ways of escaping and finally escaped, got back to his people, and told them about the monster rat. They managed to kill the rat by dumping some ravens down in the upper hole, and the rat stuck his tail out, and they managed to hack off the tip of the rat's tail, and the rat finally apparently bled to death. After they killed the rat, it was no simple matter for these people to butcher the carcass. In fact, they couldn't haul it out of its hole, and they had to wait till a big tide came and washed it out of the bottom of the hole, and they washed the carcass ashore. And they butchered this rat for its skin, because the rat skin, even though the hair, which was as long as a black bear's fur, even though the hair was going in places, the skin was a great prize. And they kept this rat skin, and not just anybody could sit on the rat skin, but only important people could sit on the rat skin. Well, and some neighboring tribe heard about this rat skin, and so they went to war with them to get the rat skin, and they slaughtered them. The one side slaughtered the other, and Anna tells it in such a way as you can't tell which side slaughtered which side, but it was essentially... it's clear that it didn't matter which side slaughtered which side, and that, of course, has a huge lesson to all of us, even to this day. She's telling a lot more than the story itself has to tell, and if you put it together with the first story, you can't help comparing this with exactly the same thing. Exactly the same insight that Dean Swift, the writer of Gulliver's Travels, had back over 200 years ago, where he makes great fun, as Annie does in both these cases too, of people's concept of their importance and stature in this world or universe.
There'll be more about the late Anna Nelson Herry and the book prepared in her honor by linguist Michael Krause on the next Chinook. I'm Karen Michelle McPherson. Chinook is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.
Chinook, it's a warm wind.
It's a changing wind.
Chinook, a program for and about Alaskan natives.
Chinook Echoes is looking back into native heritage.
How things are and how they got that way.
Chinook Patterns is information.
Issues that affect the patterns of Alaskan life.
Chinook Profiles, portraits of people, places, events.
But mostly the people who are Alaskans.
Welcome to Chinook. I'm Karen Michelle McPherson. In the last program, we heard linguist Michael Krause of the University of Alaska talk about his work with Anna Nelson Harry, an Eyak Indian, one of the last speakers of that language. She died in February 1982. In her honor, Professor Krause, who spent, he estimates, 15 years working with Annie and with the language, has prepared a book of 10 of her stories. For she was a particularly gifted storyteller, a talented artist of the oral tradition of her people. As she told them, the stories would vary from telling to telling. Professor Michael Krause.
Much of the interest in hearing the way a story is told is in the way a story is told this particular time by this individual. We're lucky to have two versions of some of these stories. Some of these stories that Annie told, she told in 1933 to Frederica de Laguna and Kai Bjarke Smit on the Danish-American expedition, which spent 17 days with the Eyak, which is the only anthropological work ever done with Eyak. Galusha, Annie's husband, was the one who was really the interpreter for that expedition. But the source of the information, especially of the folk tales that are published in that book, was Annie herself telling them in Eyak to Galusha, who then translated them into English for the anthropologists. So we have at least those English translations of Annie telling the stories back when she was 27 years old. And still married to an Eyak. And then, later on, in 1960s, when Annie was about 60, we again have her telling these stories as a much older person who is whose experience in life is even deeper and more complex than it had been in 1927. And to compare the way those two stories are told, one can readily see, for instance, in the way the Lake Dwarf's story is told and Giant Rat's story is told, that here is a person who has seen smaller nations eaten up by larger nations and those larger nations eaten up by still larger nations. Just again like Dean Swift. He made fun of the English and French because he was neither English or French, but he was a member of a smaller nation, the Irish. We have two versions of the way Annie tells the story about the careless hunter who does not observe taboos and does not release this special little white groundhog that he was told by a mountain woman to release. Instead, he falls in love with the little groundhog girl and marries her and then has to go and live amongst the groundhogs. If I'm correct, she first has to live with him amongst people. And gets lonesome and goes back to her people, and then he follows her and lives amongst the groundhogs, and it's not happy either way. And the tragedy of that and of the relations between the groundhogs and people is more what this story is about, a story about a person's identity and the experience of having moved from one culture and one kind to another, which there's a great deal of emotional resonance in the way she tells the story, personal feeling that goes way beyond what the story on the surface is all about. And you can hear that in her voice as she tells the story. The way the book is organized, I have the giant rat and the little lake people as section one, where Annie is philosophically talking about greatness and smallness. And then in the second section, I have a single story which Annie has put together out of two different stories about a supposedly bad sister and a supposedly good sister. One is also virtuous, and the other is the opposite. And how they end up and what real virtue is not what it seems to be on the surface of these two stories, and many levels of meaning of that, too. And the third section, in which we have three stories, is composed of accounts of intermarriages between one kind and another. A woman who is taken away by octopus, a woman who is captured by wolves, and the man who marries a groundhog. And the relationships between the different kinds and the feeling of the person. For Annie, this is the person who is identified with both kinds. Is very, very deep, and is told with feelings you can't possibly miss if you listen to the tape itself. In the last section of the book, I have two texts, which together I call On the Beginning and End of EAC History. One is Annie's response to my repeated questions. If the EACs had any tradition about where they came from. And I've never seen this confirmed anywhere in the folk literature, but nor could I ever get it reconfirmed by Annie, but she tells a story of how the ancestors of the EX came down the Copper River, came to the shore, found a good land, found eggs, for instance, and like those and many other wonderful things. And some more of their relatives came down after them, and they settled there and had a good life. And it even goes somewhat into how they evolved better and better canoes and better houses and developed a good life around Eyak and Alleghanic, where Annie grew up. Then the last part of the book, Annie sang a lament for her people, in which she asks, "Where have all my aunts and uncles gone? And why is it, how is it that I alone survive?" She was a very spry, very full of nervous energy, not a quiet lady. And I suppose in keeping with that, she was on the thin side. But I always just knew her as a very interesting, very lively-minded and lively old lady. She was about 60 or nearly that when I first met her. And full of, always full of energy. Never, her hands were always busy doing something, and in some ways old and even feeble as she was. It was hard for me to keep up with her, if not physically, at least intellectually.
Can you tell me about the EAC language? What is EAC?
EAC people have their own language. This is a fact was fairly well known to the Russians, but in the transfer of Alaska this knowledge did not transfer to the Americans, who more or less lost track of who the EX were. And it wasn't until 1930 and 1933, when Freddy de Laguna was in Prince William Sound, that the EX were again recognized by anthropologists and academics as being their own tribe. Even the people living around Cordova, even some people intermarried with EX, were not aware of the fact that EX was neither what is locally called Aleut, nor was it Tlingit, nor was it Athabascan, but it was its own language. On the other hand, it is related to all of the Athabascan languages. Yet it's no more closely related to the Athabascan of Copper River Athabascan or Atna, than it is to Navajo. It is equally distant from all Athabascan languages. And that means, prehistorically, that the Eyak people must have been separated for at least 2,000-3,000 years from any other people whose language has come down to us. Where they could have been separated and pocketed on the coast, probably somewhere for 2,000-3,000 years, practically out of contact with anybody else whose language has come down to us, is hard to understand. And that just goes to show that the prehistory of EAC is a mysterious thing and teaches us a good lesson that we should not claim to know or understand more than fragments of the past.
How and why is it that you got so involved in a language that few people have heard of and even less people spoke at the time that you came along?
Maybe all the more reason that somebody should be interested in that. Because, number one, if nobody got interested in it when they did, it would be something that would be lost to our knowledge and recollection forever. Also, as I suppose I have pointed out in a way before, Annie pointed out better than I, that the size of something, in this case of sheer numbers of people, is not necessarily a measure of its importance or value or worth. And Annie has surely told us better than anyone else that I know of, and in more or less the same way as Dean Swift, that smaller nations have just as much to teach us as larger nations. There are other languages in Alaska which are spoken by many, many more people, and that's a good thing. But the importance of EAC and the lesson of EAC is something for all Alaskans, both in the sense of learning that a small nation has that much to teach us, but also the sad lesson of what has happened to the EX, who are the first known Alaska Native language group that will soon be no more. And let it not happen anywhere else.
In honor of EAC, The Art of Anna Nelson Harry, a book compiled by Dr. Michael Krause of the University of Alaska, a memorial to Anna, who died in February 1982, and a tribute to the EAC Nation. I'm Karen Michelle McPherson. Chinook is a production of KUAC-FM at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks.